This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Colin Reedy, Head of Active Strategies, and Lars Krekel, Global Equity Strategist. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning.
Good morning, Max.
Well, in today's call, the first of the second half of 2021, we'll assess how markets might interact with evolving monetary and fiscal policy over the coming months as the global economy continues to lift itself out of a COVID-induced rut. So, with no further ado, Sonia, let's start where we always do. What do investors need to know about the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets today?
Thank you, Max, and good morning, everyone. As you outline, Max, it's indeed a good time to take a step back, have a look, and assess on where we are in the economic cycle. You've already mentioned the three very important areas to look out for. First and foremost, as always, vaccination versus latest virus developments. Second, where are we in the normalization of the global economy and what are the differences that we are seeing across particular developed versus emerging markets? And then last but not least, linked to the idea of the two stimulus areas you've highlighted, i.e. fiscal and monetary stimulus, but clearly what investors should watch out for, what are the inflationary pressures emerging and hence the drivers with regards to monetary policy? So let's look at these one by one, because I always like to look at them in isolation first before then bringing it all together. And then clearly today we have a fixed income and an equity specialist on the call, so then we can delve into greater detail on what this means actually for investors looking at the different asset classes. Now, with regards to vaccination versus virus, I'm pretty sure it will be all eyes on the UK, given that the government yesterday announced the way forward and the reopening on the 19th of July, with further restrictions falling. And clearly this is happening against the backdrop of surging cases of the Delta variant. And we know that the so-called R value, i.e. the reproductive value of the virus, is far higher than what we have experienced so far. So it does feel a little bit like a gamble, because you're lifting restrictions against the backdrop of massively surging cases. But it's very clear the reason why everyone is watching is, will it work? Will the immunization and the herd immunity occur faster in the context of obviously vaccinations working and then a broader part of the population being immune against the variant? That clearly is something I'm sure Europe will watch very carefully, because we have seen the Delta variant now being the more dominant strain even in Europe. And so this will be watched very carefully to see whether this might be a blueprint for other countries to follow. The positive news is, and this is why I think we haven't seen any major reaction market, is that vaccinations clearly seem to work in the context that the surge in cases has not led yet to a surge in hospitalization rates or death. And that clearly means that vaccinations are effective in breaking exactly that causality that everybody has been watching so carefully, because clearly it is all about whether this new Delta variant will lead to more pressures and strains on health system. And as such, if that were to be true, then clearly we have a clearer path forward. Now, the last element to mention around vaccinations and virus is what I've alluded to already. There is a different speed of the vaccination rollout. We have seen the developed world in particular, led by the UK, the US, and now Europe, having a far higher speed of rolling out vaccinations, with far greater shares than 50% already vaccinated. We are seeing a pickup in emerging markets, but obviously we need to think about this in the context of the far more infectious Delta variant, if that were to travel to emerging markets with a much lower percentage of the population already immunized, that clearly could cause disruption and probably would lead to further restrictive measures being applied. Maybe worth mentioning that for the time being, we have not adjusted our economic growth forecast on the back of the latest news around the Delta variant. So we still assume that the normalization will continue as before, and that if anything, yes, there might be some small regional restrictions, but that it will not change the path of this cyclical recovery. What it does raise as well is clearly the risk of further variants emerging in the future, and the big risk that one of these variants might be resistant to the existing vaccines. We should never forget that this is still an evolution, but for the time being, we do not have the evidence that would point in that direction. Now, if we then look at the economic rebound, clearly it is well underway. It is strong, led by the US, but clearly it's taking hold now here in the UK, in Europe as well. So as discussed before, no changes to our forecasts here. It is very much a recovery led by excess demand, clearly very much bolstered by very strong household balance sheets. And this, there's no change in the way we look at the economy from that angle. In fact, in the US, we are currently looking at where we are in the cycle. That might sound a bit strange because given that we've really just reopened, but it is the speed with which the cyclical recovery is unfolding. And clearly this is linked to the enormous amount of stimulus, monetary and fiscal, which has led the cycle to occur in a much shorter period of time compared to history. And our economics team, in fact, is watching for mid-cycle or late-cycle warning signs emerging. Clearly only for the US right now, but a very interesting debate, in particular when we come to the inflationary pressures emerging on the back of this. The message from central banks so far has remained very supportive. And this is very interesting, particularly in the context of the massive inflationary surprises that we have seen in the US, and quite a interesting and heated debate earlier in the year of what is transitory and what are permanent price pressures emerging. There's been a lot of focus on bottlenecks emerging, particularly in the semiconductor space, which had a big impact on car production and some other areas. So that we are watching carefully, because that clearly has led to very interesting price movements. There's very obvious transitory effects, for example, on airfares, hotel prices, and other areas that clearly are big beneficiaries of reopening. But it and then the last one is the labor market, where there has been a very interesting phenomenon that the labor market data came in below expectation, has been a softer print, and hence a big question mark on whether the support payments from the US government in particular, but clearly in place here in the UK and Europe as well, that do they have an impact on the way how people think about their re-entry in the labor market? And will this form part of their own, price and inflationary outlook? And hence, will it have an impact on wage negotiations in the future? That is probably the area we're watching most carefully in order for us to understand whether we are indeed looking at an inflection point when it comes to the inflationary backdrop. And I'm sure Colin will pick this up in a minute, because clearly that has huge implications on how we should look at the global bond space and credit markets. So far, as I said, the message remains supportive. We know that the Fed is focusing on their average inflation targeting, and the expectation from the Fed and from us is that towards the end of 22, we will see inflationary pressures fall back to the 2% range, i.e. bang on target of the Fed's range. And as such, we can see how the market is currently looking through this and is waiting for either further evidence of price pressures to be more sticky than what we currently think, and hence obviously would then look towards the Fed and the communication they're putting out there. So in terms of the market backdrop, and now bringing it all together, because it clearly is still a very supportive backdrop from an economic point of view. It is still a very supportive backdrop from a stimulus point of view, both monetary and fiscal. And so the question is, how much is in the price already? How much have markets already taken all that positive news and priced it in? And not surprisingly, we've had a lot more, papers from strategists on valuation levels and whether we are at the top, which clearly for some asset classes is the case. I think the latest I've seen was on the US market, which the author claimed is at an all-time high with regards to several valuation measures. And that, as we know, is never a good immediate indicator for some action, but clearly gives you a snapshot on how we should look at the attractiveness and the relative attractiveness of various asset classes against the backdrop of what I've just outlined. And I shall stop here and hand back to you, Max.
Thank you very much for that overview. Let's turn to Colin now and dig into some of the themes you've just touched on, Sonia. Colin, market volatility remains relatively low, partly as a result of investors taking a sanguine view of the Fed's moderately hawkish pivot of late. Is the approach of peak central bank liquidity being correctly priced in your view?
Thanks, Max. I think I'd call it a tweak rather than a pivot.
Right.
So the emphasis should definitely be on the word moderate here, I think. From an equity or riskier asset class perspective, the reaction has been relaxed, as we've discussed. And I think recent established trends have been more than happy to continue. Equity indices have powered on. Sure, Lars will come on to talk about this in more detail in a minute. Albeit with some ongoing rotation in the fixed income postcode, both high yield and emerging market debt markets have continued to do well. But there's obviously been an outsized reaction in risk-free government bonds, which I think is what's captured most of the headlines of late. The key message I'd like to get across on the call is that we don't think the reflation trade is over, just better priced, as it's become, you know, more of a consensus view in markets this year. The tweak to Fed guidance was as good an excuse for a bit more of a sort of market wobble, maybe acknowledging some of these heady valuations that Sonia mentioned. But trends, you know, will always withstand wobbles, and that's certainly the price action that we've witnessed since. But rates moved a lot, as I said. We think this has actually got more to do with poor positioning than a fundamental reevaluation of the cycle or growth expectations or whatever. Being short duration or long inflation, we think became consensus positions for a lot of investors, and we think it's been a sort of forced unwind of these, certainly within the hedge fund community, according to the flow analysis that we monitor, that's actually driven the move. We think the flow that's amplified the move is more interesting, and that's coming from the US pension space, US pension funds. And the amplification there is because their funding ratios are creeping up or have been creeping up to sort of near 100%, and we think there's been a bit of a scramble to lock in these good funding ratios at the pension fund level. Back to the sort of reflation to inflation narrative, we've spoken consistently, you know, about 18 months worth of pent up frustrated demand hitting impaired supply curves, as I say, for a good while now. That's understood by most, we think, and as Sonia's alluded to, we're definitely seeing that. The US-led sort of goods-driven move higher in inflation right now is, I think, it's surprised most, we sense, in terms of its impact. The numbers have been far higher than expected initially, but there's obviously a lot of noise contained in that data right here, right now. I think the crucial point in terms of not thinking that this story has fully played out yet is we think it will now shift to a combination of services and housing costs. And this is where it could get, or it could become the real deal. That's certainly where we're spending a lot of our research effort focused on within LGM at the moment. Back to you, Max.
Thanks, Colin. Well, against the backdrop that you've just outlined, where the reflation trade, reopening trade isn't over but is better priced, how is the global fixed income team positioning?
Okay, well, let's kick off with the rates and duration and inflation view, given we've spoken about that. The team successfully identified the potential for yields to move higher later last year. As I say, we've talked about it quite a lot in our publications. That thankfully generated significant alpha for our funds during the first quarter of this year, in particular as 10-year treasuries moved from, I think, less than 1% to almost 1.8%. In less than 3 months. We have no outright duration position here currently at the moment, but we do have strong views on the curve, especially in the sort of 10s to 30 year part of the yield curve. And that's very focused in the US, where we're positioned for further flattening of that curve. On inflation, we stay short and in the money. That position has performed well during last week's equity weakness, and we came close to actually booking sort of performance gains that we'd earned, but it's since rebounded. Our rationale here remains unchanged. Inflation expectations can't get particularly high before the Fed's reaction function starts feeding back and pushing them down. And there's also sort of one added benefit we think of the position is that it tends to do well in equity drawdowns, at least since we've had a sort of proper US inflation market to measure against. Other stuff that's front of mind in this area for us is, you know, you'd have seen of late is China pulling policy levers that look like loosening conditions. You know, why are they doing that? You know, is it because growth domestically is worse than we thought? You know, in the context of a largely US reflation driven backdrop, I think it's important to remember that, you know, China is still a large deflationary force in the world. Moving to credit, we highlighted on our recent quarterly outlook, we've definitely got more cautious in investment grade, given valuations. But actually, as you move down the sort of credit quality spectrum, you know, confidence is higher. Within high yield, the team are plus two on a sort of minus three to plus three scale, to give it context. Key issues for them are the strong positive fundamentals, and that's translating into sort of, you know, ever lower default forecasts. A sort of evaporating default in environment is very much underpinning you know, the healthy dynamic in that market at the moment. You know, they're more comfortable than I am. You know, despite tight spreads, they are very focused on the XX spread relative to anticipated capital loss from future defaults, especially in the BB and single B parts of that market. In emerging market debt, it's been hard yards so far this year. The team's navigated a really challenging 6 months very well, albeit in a sort of lower returns context. Confidence is definitely higher for the second half of the year. They expect growth expectations to improve in emerging markets, you know, as vaccination programs, you know, roll out and catch up with where the developed nations are today. However, they do believe that it will still be about identifying idiosyncratic stories, avoiding the bad ones and capturing the good ones, rather than just an overall increase in the beta of the portfolio. Within that, they've got a strong preference for hard over local currency debt. You know, if markets expect more from the Fed going forward, that might draw a line under US dollar weakness, which, you know, could swiftly become a headwind for emerging market local currency debt. I'll hand back to you, Max, there.
Talking about corporate stories brings us very nicely on to earnings season. Lars, this is something you've covered on the Elgin blog recently. What do early indications suggest about the second quarter company earnings season and the broader equity market outlook?
Yes, I guess. So when it comes to the second quarter earnings season, things really get going this week. in the US, particularly Europe is a little bit later in results, and we're going to get financials first of all. I think today we start getting the first of the big banks reporting, actually. But even before we get the actual results coming in, there are plenty of leading indicators or early indications you can look at. And I think by and large, they've looked pretty promising overall. If you look at the pre-announcements from companies, so companies that comment before their results because they're expecting something significantly better or worse than they've been previously talking about. Those are always quite anecdotal, of course, but by and large, they've been mainly positive. And we've had, for example, today in Nokia again continuing that pattern. But maybe just as telling is just the absence of any high profile profit warnings that we have seen, which you often get in the past. So there hasn't been that negative sort of background noise to pre-announcements at all this time around. Also, a number of companies have different quarter ends. So these early reporting companies have been giving us numbers the last few weeks, last couple of months. They're not as many and they're not as perfectly spread out across all the sectors as maybe a full reporting season. But again, by and large, they've been quite good numbers, beating analyst estimates, and the share prices have typically responded positively as well. So that's another kind of small piece to the puzzle that looks positive. But for me, maybe the most interesting or the data point has been analyst estimates or the revisions of those estimates. Again, you don't get quite as many in between earnings seasons, but what there has been predominantly or almost extremely positive. In the US, if you just take the last, say, month and a half or so, about three quarters of the analysts that have changed their forecasts have changed them to the upside. It's a high number naturally, but it's the kind of number, the kind of ratio you normally only get right after a recession in the first few months right afterwards. Or we had it very briefly at the end of 2017 when the US cut corporation taxes. We had lots of analyst upgrades. So it's quite unusual to see a high ratio like that, a good year now into the recovery. So I think taking all of those things together, it bodes well for the earnings season as in general. I think it's not that likely, at least from a macro perspective, that you get any big shockers hidden there. Of course, you can always have negative stories on an individual company level. And I think it adds some confidence to the view that we're still seeing analyst upgrades to earnings forecasts in a significant way. And of course, that maybe brings it back to valuations a little bit. All else equal, significant earnings upgrades by analysts have a downward drag on valuation multiples, which in aggregate clearly are at the high end of the historic ranges, particularly so in the US. Some multiples are at historic extremes. It's maybe not quite the case in all regions that all multiples are as extreme, but it's impossible to argue that equities are in an outright way cheap today. But to some degree, the earnings season and the subsequent analyst upgrades will help ease maybe some of those numbers. I would be much more concerned, let's say, if in a year and a half's time, we had similar PE multiples that we have today. You can kind of live with it in a situation where you still expect earnings to ramp up in the next year or so. And maybe the only comfort you could take from the valuation picture, at least if you look at it from an asset allocation perspective, is that relative to other asset classes, perhaps equities still look on the attractive side. But that is largely only the case because all asset classes look historically expensive. So when it's a matter of picking something that is relatively cheap, you can find something that looks more interesting than something else. But in an absolute sense, it's difficult to find great value today.
Well, thank you for talking through those dynamics, Lars. And let's now move from asset class to sector. Shawnak last month on the call talked about the tech sector from the perspective of a stock picker. What's the asset allocation team's current stance on tech stocks and why?
Yeah, I think we come out probably at a similar place as Shawnak. I would say we like tech about as much as Shawnak does from a bottom-up side, but yeah, probably for different arguments, more macro-driven arguments. Maybe the first one, the most topical one is inflation, which you know, Colin and Sonia both alluded to already as well. That's something where I think in aggregate tech relative to other parts of the equity space looks relatively well positioned. If you're thinking about rising wage costs, for example, the wage bills of tech companies is one of the lowest in relation to their overall revenues or their overall cost basis. So if that's a dynamic you're worried about, then tech is relatively well positioned. If you think inflation will play out into higher raw materials prices, again, tech doesn't rely that much on raw materials themselves. So relative to other parts of the equity space, well positioned. And then in the equity world, if inflation becomes a big issue, then pricing power is something that helps differentiate between companies. And I would say at the very least, tech is not at a disadvantage there relative to other parts of the market. And I think you can probably make a pretty good case that pricing power in many areas is stronger than elsewhere. So I think from that inflation dynamic, tech is an interesting place to be. But bigger picture, and that's kind of the reason we've been overweight tech or long tech for the last few years, is just that the earnings growth has been superior to the rest of the market. And we would generally expect that to continue in the years ahead. And I would say that the pandemic has probably increased the confidence in that view further. We've all seen in our lives the accelerated adoption of many technologies. And of course, some of that may be volatile, as accelerated particularly during the lockdowns. And there may be some reversal as economies reopen as well. But I think overall tech will come out of the pandemic stronger than it went in relative to the rest of the market. And that's how we think about that. So that's something I think where the dynamics continue to be positive. And of course, you have to admit that we're not the only ones who have discovered that tech is doing quite well on the profit side. But I think the encouraging thing is that valuations, though I would not try to make the case that tech is cheap, but relative to the growth that is being delivered and is likely to be delivered, I think valuations still look pretty reasonable. And if you look at the outperformance that's been delivered over the last few years, it's been the vast majority of it has come from superior earnings growth rather than valuations expanding, which would have been more concerning. So I think that gives you a little bit of comfort that expectation levels aren't excessive in tech, though the sentiment picture is something that we watch quite closely around tech in order to help us maybe increase or moderate position sizes.
Let's return to the topic of stimulus. Sonia, the EU Commission is on track this month to disburse a good chunk of the funds under its Recovery and Resilience Facility, much of which are dedicated to green objectives. What investment opportunities do you see from this initiative?
Yes, thanks, Max. I think that's indeed a very interesting topic, though I probably would think that with the acceleration we have seen around the overall topic, it might feel far more natural that these, you know, that there's a large part of the money, the grants and loans will be earmarked for obviously sustainability and green propositions. And if you think what has happened over the past 1 and 2 years, then with COP26 happening, that the number of declarations from governments, companies around their plan to net zero and how they can align not only obviously on a country level, but on a corporate level to those goals clearly is a huge shift. And this is why I don't think it will get as much attention really going forward, because it will feel just as part of the overall strategic direction of travel. And this is something we have discussed in the past, and that's the reason why I've started from that broad angle, because clearly this will have an impact on investment opportunities. It will have an impact on relative pricing in markets, because investors will look at the companies and the regions that are best aligned to achieving those goals. And clearly, as we know, a lot of investment will be will be put forward in order to facilitate this. We need a lot of innovation, R&D, new technologies to make it happen. And as such, we very strongly believe that there will be opportunities in distinct themes, be it net zero, renewable energy, the carbon capture technology. But overall, I think as we've discussed a number of times, it is the way the market will start pricing relative opportunities in the context of ESG and in particular in the context of the energy transition. And I've actually been more surprised and positively surprised that the EU with their next gen plan really has been able to do this in a relatively short period of time. You know, if we think back around EU-wide investment programs, this actually has been quite a remarkable story in the context of the time it took to get to actually the phase where they can put the money to work. I know that not all countries have put plans forward, and so there will be differences, but I think seeing them starting paying out money is a very good sign, because we should not forget it is a big part on how we should think about the economic growth trajectory from 2022 beyond, right? We're all focusing very narrowly on the immediate circumstances, very much an excess demand-led cyclical recovery. But very clearly for us, particularly when we talk about inflation and stimulus measures in the future, the way these monies will be spent and spent in a productive way will be incredibly important for the future trajectory of the economic recovery.
Right. And Lars, to what extent are the Biden administration stimulus plans comparable, and how do they affect your positioning within the asset allocation team?
Yeah, I guess naturally there are some similarities and some differences between the US and European plans. I would say the biggest similarity is probably on the green side that Sonia just talked about. There is quite a lot of that in the US plans as well, particularly in the American Jobs Plan that is being discussed at the moment. It's kind of under the heading of infrastructure, but a lot of that is designed to head towards green initiatives, be it replacing leaking water pipes, upgrading the electric grid as well, which of course is essential for electrifying the economy, shifting electricity generation to more renewables. So all these things are part of the US fiscal plans as well. And then in terms of how that's impacting our portfolios, we have exposure in the multi-asset team to a basket of decarbonization stocks. So these are companies that should, I guess, both drive and also benefit from the decarbonization of the economy in the future. So the fact that it's reflected not just in one region's plans, but across many regions, is one of the reasons we have that. As far as the differences go, I think the biggest one, or the most obvious one, is in scale. So the US has already spent a far greater amount of money than Europe has. So $6 trillion of extra spending in 2020 and 2021 is just an incredibly large number. And then there is though maybe one offsetting effect as well, particularly from the equity angle. In the sense that some of that US spending will be offset with some corporation tax increases. We don't yet know the exact extent of that, but the complete plans would take about 8-9% or so of S&P 500 profits. So it is a significant amount that the equity market would care about, and we don't expect the entirety of that to ultimately be passed, maybe half of it, but that's something that also you don't see in Europe. To the same degree as a potential offset.
Thanks, Colin. Sonia, we've covered a huge amount of ground today, as we do every month. What are the key takeaways for investors, and is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes, thank you, Max. Indeed, we have covered a lot of ground, and I know that it is not always very easy to bring all the complex, input factors together to then understand where investment opportunities would lie. I think it's probably worth summarizing from what we have said today. It's very clear that we still very much are behind the strong cyclical recovery, which drives our overall positive narrative, because that is clearly what you've heard from both Lars and Colin, what is driving corporate fundamentals and hence the strength of the earnings recovery. And clearly what we've heard around credit is leading to a very benign default backdrop. So this is clearly a positive setup, And if you look at historic asset class returns, then equities, not surprisingly, is the standout, because as we heard from Lars, the earnings recovery has a much broader tone to it. It is supporting a much larger range of companies and sectors. But what you heard from both as well, from here, given the valuation backdrop, it is about understanding the structural drivers of the recovery. And ESG clearly is one of the dominating themes. But as we've heard, Lars, around technology, we haven't talked about the future of work. There's other structural drivers that will emerge and will continue arising from the pandemic that are worth looking at, because they will allow us to identify good investment opportunities. So the risk backdrop remains positive, but it's not so much around just getting market exposure. It's finding the investment opportunities around specific themes. And very clearly, we are very much in favor of understanding energy transition, climate change, human rights around the S factor, because we know that it's a topic that is evolving very quickly and will play a much more important role in the future. As Colin highlighted, we have a preference for the juicier credit areas simply because of the valuation we're looking at in investment grade. And so I think that sets the narrative. But I think, as you've heard from today's call as well, we're very aware of the average valuation level. We're very aware around the narrative around stimulus and how to watch central banks. Because as I've said right at the beginning, I think there is a good chance that we are witnessing quite a sustained inflection point this year. And as we know, this is not something that will unfold over the next 6 to 12 months, but maybe more around the next 3 to 5 years, but clearly something that will fundamentally change the way we should think around asset allocation and investment opportunities.
Thank you, Sonia. Finally, I'd just like to ask you all what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently. I will get the ball rolling and say I've been watching a great French show on Netflix called Lupin, about a gentleman thief. Sonia, would you like to go next?
The family has been watching a few of the major sporting events that have been happening recently. It's not just football, rest assured. Obviously, the tennis has been on as well. And actually, we're very much looking forward to the Olympics as well. I think it's a nice way of adding to the normal kind of Netflix series watching.
That's right. That's exactly right. Colin?
Yeah, very similar, actually. Too much sport, shifting from the Euros to the British and Irish Lions now, in terms of actual viewing pleasures.
Thank you, Colin. And Lars, finally.
Yeah, obviously sport is the top answer, but it's one thing kind of a semi-fun and semi-work related. I would flag a podcast as well, Pivot. It's called, comes out twice a week. Great, but it's interesting, insightful, and entertaining. So if you're interested in tech and business, that's always a great listen.
That's great. Of course, that's only after everyone's finished listening to every single Elgin Talks podcast. That's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Colin, and Lars, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in August. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels, on the blog, and of course here on Elgin Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgim.com.